We're in OUJLIC's Shir Kali on the Parsha, on Parshat Lech Lecha. I spent a lot of this morning basically deciding whether or not I wanted to give this Shir, which was unfortunate because then when I decided that I needed to give this Shir, I had a lot less time to prepare this Shir. The first half is ironclad. It comes from my Rebbe Rav Amos, and is something really beautiful that builds off the end of Parshat Noach, and helps us define the nature of Avram Avinu. It's something that those of you who are in the Midrashah program that we learned together in the Midrashah just last week. Where we go from there is all new. These sources are numbered. I have no idea if they're in order or not. We'll find that out together. And we'll see what conclusions and what truths we come to, because honestly, that's, in my mind, the heart and soul of this year, is to talk about truth, to talk about emet, to talk about what that means and how to find it and some of those challenges in this day and age, because that very much emanates from the essence of the Parsha, from the essence of who Avraham Avinu himself is. So let's get there. Let's do the part that we know for sure is solid. Let's talk about, from last week's Parsha, the Dor HaPalaga Migdal Bavel. And the reason why I want to talk about Migdal Bavel and why it's relevant to our Parsha, Parsha Lech Lecha, is because it's in the wake of Migdal Bavel, it's in the wake of the Tower of Babel, that we have the 10 generations that leads us to finally finding Avram Avinu. The 10 generations from Noach to Avraham come right after the story of Migdal Bavel, indicating on a text level that somehow Avram Avinu is coming as a result of or in response to Migdal Bavel. And it shouldn't necessarily be surprising. Migdal Bavel, before we get into the story itself, who is the person who stood at the height of that generation? Who is the person who instigated Migdal Bavel? Who was ruling Bavel at the time? Anybody know? Nimrod. As we discussed in Midrashah. Nimrod. And while it doesn't say that explicitly in the Psukim about Migdal Bavel, if you take a look in source number 2, it's just a few Psukim back in the previous Perek, it says, it lists the children of Cham, Perek Yud Pasuk Chet, the Kush Yalad at Nimrod. So Cham gives birth to Kush, and Kush gives birth to Nimrod. And Pasuk Yud, Vatehi Reshit Mamlachto Bavel. The head of his kingdom was Bavel. And what do we know about Nimrod? Who is the arch enemy of Nimrod? Somebody who wasn't in Midrashah, this one we should know. Who's the arch enemy of Nimrod? Avraham. Right? This, all of the stories about Avraham in his early years, the clash between Avraham and Nimrod. That's really where it reaches its apex. We'll see that midrash perhaps later. It's on the source sheet either way. But that's where that conflict comes from. So when we're learning about the story of Migdal Bavel, when we're understanding what was going on at Migdal Bavel, we're understanding the ideology of that generation. We're understanding the worldview of that generation. A worldview and ideology that's diametrically opposed to the worldview and the ideology that becomes Avraham Avinu. Which again, indicated by the text, that's why he's coming on the contrasting back onto that. That's what produces Avraham at the end of Parshat Noach to emerge in the beginning of a story in Parshat Lech Lecha. So let's try to understand what was Migdal Bavel about? What was Nimrod about? What was his generation about? What was his ideology about? So take a look at the Psukim. Take a look in source number 1. It's not a long story. The whole story itself is not Psukim long. What was the ideology of Migdal Bavel? What was their agenda? What was their worldview? Let's read the first pasuk together. It starts off very clearly defining it. Perek Yud Aleph pasuk Aleph, Vayikol ha'aretz safa achat udvarim achadim. The entire land was one tongue, meaning one language, and of a unified purpose. They lived in a society where it was all about unity, all about oneness, which is an incredible thing. The unity of that generation was like there was no unity in that as there ever was in that generation. And we see that that point is actually the point of contention between Migdal Bavel and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because look what happens when HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes down and sees what they're doing. The underline of Pasuk Vav. Vayomer Hashem, Heim Am Echad, V'Safa Achat L'Kulam. My issue with them stems from the fact that they are one nation with one language. God's issue with them was this worldview of Safa Achat Udvarim Achadim. And we see that also in God's response. Because how does God punish Migdal Bavel for whatever it is that they did wrong? He gives them different languages. He breaks the Safa Achat. He breaks up the Zorim Achadim. They're no longer unified in their purpose. And even the beginning of the first Pasuk. Vayhi kol ha'aretz. They're also dispersed amongst the entirety of the world. Every aspect of that opening Pasuk is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds by dismantling. So that's clearly the heart of the issue here. It's in the first Pasuk, the middle Pasuk, and the conclusion of the story. The question that we should be asking on this, though, is, what's wrong with that? It sounds utopian. It sounds amazing. Everybody was speaking one language. Everybody understood each other. Everybody was united in one goal and one purpose. Everybody was actually able to sit together, arms around each other by the campfire and sing Kumbaya. So what was the problem? What was the issue? Why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu possibly have an issue with the nature of their unity? Too much unity, says Elisa. Over unity. They were too close. What do you mean too close? It was overwhelming. You're overwhelmed by their unity.
If one is used for good.
So one aspect is that it was used for the negative. That's the classic approach that we're not going to use, and it's totally valid. I want to offer a different layer to that approach.
It's the death of individuality. I mean, I think that what's unique and special about humanity is our fact that we are each different, and God created us to be different. There's Adam and Chava. They're two different people, but when they were so unified, they lost what made them special. They lost their purpose.
Excellent. That there is a point at which unity can come to a place where that unity isn't positive anymore. Where that unity and the goal of the society, the overarching goal of the entire land, or the people running it, supersedes the uniqueness and the importance of the individual. This is something that we saw not so many years ago in human history. What does that sound similar to?
Genocide?
Don't have to go that far. Don't have to go that far. It could lead to that, but it doesn't go that far.
Communism.
Where there was a society, and there was an ideology, where that society took precedence over all. And if it meant sending hundreds of thousands of soldiers to their death, the individuals made no difference. Because the society, the unity of purpose, superseded all. That was the theory of the ideology. It was incredibly destructive. It was incredibly problematic. And so too here. I mentioned this in the Midrash here as well. I don't remember where I saw this Midrash. And if you could find this Midrash, please, whether you're in this room or you're listening online, email me the Midrash, the source. I want to go back and see the Midrash inside. I don't like quoting things that I haven't seen inside in a long time. Because you never know where the nuances of the language will go. But I remember very clearly seeing a Midrash that talked about this exact same issue with Migdal Bavel. That the goal was to build the tower. That was the goal of the society. They had defined that that was what they were setting out to do. That was the goal. That's what unifies us. And you know what doesn't matter? Anyone. As long as we get there. And if it meant pushing somebody out of the way and they fell from thousands of feet in the sky and died, it didn't matter if you got that next brick up. Lives of the individuals were irrelevant. All that mattered was the unity of purpose of the society. That mentality was incredibly dangerous and it crushed the sense of individuality. Which begs the question, whether it be communism or whether it be Migdal Bavel, and let's stick to Migdal Bavel. Why would anybody ever want to be a part of a society that squelches individuality to that extent? What's the benefit? Why would you want to be in a Migdal Bavel society? Why would you want to be in a communist society? What would be the draw in either of those instances?
To feel included in something that's bigger than yourself.
Awesome. I don't have to worry about who I am. I'm taken care of by the greater whole. What were you going to say?
Yeah, same thing.
Similar. That's not over unity. Those are two individual thoughts, right? That this idea, that the reason what's so attractive about this ideology is that it's safe. I'm taken care of. I don't have to figure out what I want in life. Society defines that for me. Society's going to take care of me. It's going to give me clothes, in theory. It's going to give me food to eat, in theory. It's going to keep me financially sound, in theory. I'm totally taken care of. And even more than that, again, deeper than that, which Shiri already brought up from the very beginning, is not just a sense of security, and not just a sense of I'm being taken care of and I'm part of a whole. It's the fact that I'm not required to think at all about who I am, what I want, what makes me unique. Since all that matters is the greater society at large and its goals and its agendas and its slogans, then all I have to do is simply take them in, make them a part of myself, spit them back out when I'm asked about them, and I'm taken care of, everything is good. It gives me an option, the opportunity to escape from the difficulties of becoming an individual, of facing myself, of defining who I am. There's tremendous comfort in that. And while Migdal Bavel may have fallen, and while communism may have fallen, those are issues that still speak to the heart of even religious society today. You can have two people. One person, two people who look exactly the same. Two from Jews. We'll take guys. Make it easier so we make sure we're not, nobody feels judged in the room. Right? We'll judge the guys, right? So so you have two guys. Both of them are, I'm not wearing any of these things, so I'm not ascribing to this. Both of them are wearing black hats. Both of them are wearing velvet yarmulkes. Both of them are wearing black and white and suit jackets. Both of them are davening three times a day in the same yeshiva. Both of them are learning the same number of hours in yeshiva. And they totally look exactly the same on the outside. And they could be totally, totally different. Because one person could have made the choice to ascribe to that simply because that's what they were born into, that was what their rebbeim told them to do, that's what their yeshiva told them to do, and there's no individual thought process involved. And to a certain extent, despite the fact that that person is wearing quote-unquote the dress that needs to be dressed, and is doing quote-unquote what they're supposed to be doing, and of course, a Jewish man is supposed to be davening three times a day and they're supposed to be learning. But if that person has never gone through the process to ask themselves, why am I doing this? It's incredibly problematic. It's not living up to being who one is meant to be. There are still dangers of conforming to societal norms, even when what you're doing is good. And if that other person, who looks the same, did the internal work necessary to fight for it, to think to themselves, why am I or am I not wearing a black hat? Why am I or am I not wearing a jacket? Why am I or am I not giving up all color in my life? Why am I or am I not davening three times a day? Why am I or am I not learning this number of hours a day? And why am I learning or not learning this yeshiva? The two people could be doing the exact same thing, but they're two totally different people. One of them has earned who they are, and one of them hasn't. One of them is symptomatic of the issues of Migdal Bavel, even doing things that are correct, which, by the way, will likely lead to issues for that person down the road when they realize that they don't recognize who they are when the day comes. And the other person has earned everything that they are. And that's somebody who's, as we'll see, that's somebody who's living the way that a Jew is really meant to be living. You want to see something? Is that a hand? I saw that. Oh, okay. Switching gears. Avram Avinu is the opponent of Nimrod, and therefore the opponent of this entire ideology. Avram Avinu grows up in a generation with a singular pagan ideology. Everybody is doing Avodah Zarah. That's the only option of what there is to do. There isn't anybody left who believes in one God. And it's not even just that he lives in a society of Avodah Zarah. His father is one of the best peddlers, the best salesmen of Avodah Zarah that there are. He grows up in a household that makes its whole parnas off of Avodah Zarah, that's focused on Avodah Zarah. That's his whole life. And Avram Avinu isn't satisfied with that. Avram Avinu asks deep and important questions. Aramunu is determined to find out what the nature of reality really is. And he spends the first 70 years of his life seeking answers and questioning and being determined to come to the truth. Not settling for anything that doesn't make sense to him. Seeking truth in the deepest way possible. Which leads him even to, unsurprisingly, come into direct conflict with Nimrod. You read the stories about Avram Avinu. He was a person who simply wouldn't accept something at face value. That's what this midrash here in source number 6, we won't read the whole thing inside, I'll quote some of it outside. It talks about what Avram Avinu went through. You should see it inside, but it's incredible what Avram Avinu went through. The story that most people are familiar with is in this midrash. Incredible story. That there was a woman who came to this shop that was owned by his family. So his father went off for the day and said, "Listen, Abraham, you take care of the shop for the day." First mistake, never leave your shop in the hands of your kid. Right? So he goes off for the day. And this woman comes in and she says, "Here, I brought a korban, basically, and give it to one of the idols." So she leaves. Avinu goes, he places it in the middle, and he takes an axe, and he smashes all of the idols except for the biggest idol, and then puts the axe in the hand of the largest idol. His father comes home. He says, "What happened?" He says, "You wouldn't believe it." He says, "What do you mean? Who did this?" He said, "Well, this woman came in, and she said to give this korban to the best idol that we had." And everybody, all the idols started to argue who was the biggest and best one and the most important idol, the true god of all the gods. And they started arguing about it. And they got into this huge brawl. And so, of course, that idol, that was the biggest one. So he won. He smashed all of them to prove he was the greatest so he could take the korban. To which his father looked at him and said, "Are you out of your mind? Do you think I'm stupid?" I'm embellishing the midrash now. "You think I'm stupid? These things can't move, they can't talk, they can't argue, they can't fight, they can't smash each other. Of course that didn't happen." To which Avram Avinu looks at his father, and don't take this as a lesson in Kibbutz Avaim, this is not how you should treat one of your parents, but this is an issue of idolatry. He turns to his father and he says, "You're absolutely right. They can't. So why are you bowing down to them?" Can you imagine being faced with that truth? Avram Avinu is amazing. Let's put him on the shelf for a second. Can you imagine being the father of Abraham and your kid looking at you? It's always our kids who force us to be the most honest with ourselves. You'll find this when you have kids. They see everything. They have no filter yet because society builds us to package things in nicer ways. And they say it like it is. Your kids are the best way to know where you're holding because they will call you out on everything. And his kid looks at him and calls him out. And he has an existential moment there. What are his two options? He could look at his son and say, "Wow, that is a really compelling question. Let's talk about that." Or he could say, "You heretic." Inside he's saying, "I don't know the answer, I don't know what to do." So what does he do? He says, "I know what to do, I'll prove him wrong." And he drags his kid to Nimrod and says, "Nimrod, I've got this problematic child who's asking really weird questions about Avodah Zarah." Potentially putting his kid's life on the line rather than face himself. But he knew that. Remember, that's the part that doesn't get emphasized. Avram's father made the choice to not look at himself in the mirror, but instead to drag his son to Nimrod and threaten his son's life. To which Nimrod does exactly that. Nimrod's sitting at the top, so he's thought about this for 5 minutes. His father hadn't thought about it for 5 minutes at all. Okay, fine, Nimrod thought about it for 5 minutes. He goes, "Bow down to the fire." It's all in the Midrash. "Bow down to the fire." So what's Avram going to say? "Why would I bow down to fire? That's weird. Water can extinguish fire." He goes, "You're right." Okay, at least he's got intellectual honesty, right? Thank God for Nimrod, right? Like, "You're right. Bow down to the water." And Avram says, "Bow down to the water? Why would I do that? The water comes from the clouds. Clouds just carry water around. Clouds are much more powerful." So he goes, "Bow down to the clouds." So he goes, "Well, why'd I do that?" It's all Midrash. "Why'd I do that? The wind blows the clouds around. Like, you can imagine, like, Nimrod at this point is like, whatever, man, just bow down to something. He goes, bow down to the wind. He goes, bow down to the wind. Human beings breathe in and out wind. At which point he says, you know what? I'm done having this conversation because intellectual honesty only goes for so long, right? End goal was Avodah Zarah, and clearly Avramin wasn't going to get there. He says, fine, my God's the fire. You think your God's such a big shot? I'll put you against my God and see what happens. And so he grabs Avram Avinu and throws him into a fiery furnace, and Avram Avinu, this I didn't see in the Medrash, but the way that my daughter's little Medrash Sez puts it, was actually very cute, was that he just sort of like walked around there in the furnace and let the fire burn away the binds that were tying up his hands and just like hung out there until the fire went out. I don't know if that's just an embellishment by little Medrash Sez, but it's a much more compelling end to the story, right? But that it didn't burn him. Because he had conviction. Because he had spent years and years and years following the road to get to the truth. That was Avraham Avinu. He would settle for nothing less. To the point where he's seeing a Kadosh Baruch Hu, he knows that God is. He knows that there is one God. And he doesn't care what anybody else has to say. I don't care what my father has to say. I don't care what the whole world is doing. I don't care what Nimrod says. I don't care if you throw me into a fiery furnace. Because I don't think that there's a God who controls fire. And I don't believe that there's a God who controls fire. I know with certainty, because of my own internal investigations and my determination for truth, I know that there is one God and he is in control of fire. And that's the tragedy of the end of the Medrash. You know what the pasuk that this Medrash is on? We don't like to talk about it, because it's a sad end to the story. Look at the first words in source number 6. It's on Vayamat Haran al Pnei Terach Aviv. It's about the death of Haran. Because what's the conclusion of the Medrash? Haran, Avram's brother, is standing there watching this whole thing, of course not intervening. Right? And we get an insight into what's going on in Haran's mind. He's sitting there going, alright, I'm going to play safe odds. If Avram burns, I'll join Nimrod. If my brother, who I love, doesn't die a horrible fiery death, then I'll join Avram. That's based on what? That's based on what investigation? That's based on what internal work? He's sitting there going, okay, whoever wins, I'll choose the winning side. And that's what he does. And so when Avramita walks out of the fiery furnace, he gets thrown into the fiery furnace, but he doesn't walk out. Because the fire of his conviction wasn't there, and only the fire of the conviction of truth was able to overcome the fire of the furnace itself. That's the difference. That's the tragedy of the story. That's what Pasuk is on. It's explaining how Haran died. It's that Haran was a different type of conformist. He was a different type of person who lacked individuality. But that was never going to produce the birth of the Jewish people. And that's how Avraham Avinu becomes defined. Source number 3. In Parshat Lech Lecha, this Parsha, Avram's defined as Avraham Ha'ivri. Says the Midrash, source number 4, what does it mean, Avraham Ha'ivri? We translate it as Abraham the Hebrew. That's nice, that's not helpful. What is Mazda Avraham Ha'ivri? What's the meaning of the word Ivri, La'avor? Says the Midrash, I'll be Midrash, but this Midrash is saying, what's the word Ivri? Kol Ha'olam Me'iver Echad Hu'me'iver Echad. Imagine that there was a river that divided the entire world. The whole world's on one side of the river, and Avram's like, peace out. I know you guys are on the losing side. I've done the investigations. I'm going to take my little raft and go on to the other side, and I'll wait for you from the other side. Because I know I'm supposed to be here. I've worked for it, I've earned it, and I know that that is the truth. That's what makes Avram Avinu Avram Avinu. That's what leads to the opening of this week's Parsha. Vayomar Hashem el Avraham, God says to Avraham, Lech Lecha. God is relating to Avraham based on who Avraham is. He's reflecting what Avraham accomplished. God doesn't give us things for free. He relates to us based on who we are. What did Avraham spend his whole life doing? He spent his whole life walking down the road less traveled to find the truth. And so what's the first thing that God says to him? Lech. Keep walking. You're on the right track. Keep walking. And walk where? Lecha. Go to you. Don't stop now. 70 years later and you still believe in me? You still know that I'm the truth? Keep going and keep digging deeper and deeper inside of yourself. Who are you? Because you understand that the deeper you are, the deeper you find the essence of truth, you look internally and define who you are and what you are. You get to the essence of your own truth, you'll find me. So lech lecha. And leave everything behind because you've already done it. Internally you have, it's time to walk away. Me'artzecha, u'me'artzecha, u'me'tavicha, el'ha'aret sh'arecha, to the land that I will show you. And I know you're going to. If you're willing to walk into a fiery furnace for me, just start walking, and trust me, you'll land in a good place. That's how we get to Avraham Avinu. That's what it means to be an Avraham Avinu. That's what it means for all of us, for all generations, to ignite our Avraham Avinu genes. The genes of our deepest ancestor, from where we come from. It means to fight for truth. And so ends the part of Shir that I am convinced about, and starts the beginning of the Shir that I'm not so convinced about. Where I'd like to share with you some things that I believe are true. Some things that I've been struggling with. But I want to couch that in saying that these are things that have been flowing through my mind, in particular over the last 10 months. Things that I've been struggling with, talking about a lot with people who are willing to actually have conversations, which are very few and far between. Because I think that there are some critical issues of our generation. I think it's a mistake, and in previous generations we could have said it and it wouldn't have been a problem to say, lech lecha, go to you. Go to you, find your truth. Because that presumes a world where when you go and you seek truth, when you seek your truth, that you're actually seeking truth at all. And I think it's a very dangerous thing to say in this generation, that lech lecha means simply go to you. Because in our day and age, we live in a society where there's a conformity of individuality. We live in a society where all truths are equal. We live in a society where it's all about me. We live in a society that at face value, on the surface, looks like a society of Avraham Avinus, but I deeply believe is a society of Bavel. Where I am being an individual just like everybody else. And that's just as dangerous. Because if I'm defining back to the same people, right now, let's take our two modern-day people, you know, outside here in New York, right? You can certainly find people who look like this. Right? Take your modern-day people. And so, they're figuring out, how do I define myself? Well, I'm gonna choose this jacket because this jacket is... I've never seen somebody wear this jacket yet. And I'm gonna dye my hair this color because I haven't seen somebody dye their hair that color yet. And I'm going to choose this way of defining myself because it combines two things that nobody's combined ever before. It's become a cult of individuality. Where people aren't necessarily thinking, who am I? It's not a search for my... It's not a search for my truth. It's just a search for me to stand out and be different, face value, than anybody else. I've said this in other shiurim, and I try not to do these types of shiurim very often. I try to keep my opinions to myself. I don't believe these are opinions, and I think that these are very deep issues of reality today, and that's why I decided that I wanted to talk about them. But when we say the word for face, bismanazeh, what's the word for face in Hebrew? Panim. Panim is a very tricky word. How else can you put vowels in the word panim? What other word do you get? What word do you get? Panim or pnim. Panim means a face, my most external side of myself. Pnim means my insides, the inner places within myself, bifnim, inside. Who I am on the outside is supposed to be a complete and perfect reflection of the essence of who I am on the inside. I think one of the most overt reflections of the brokenness of our world today is the fact that everybody's on Facebook. Facebook is the checker of that reality. It's a place where I'm trying to expose and put out my most external self in a way that will stand out, despite the fact that I don't really think to what extent it reflects who I am. The internet as a whole has become a place for people just to shout and yell and scream and share their point of view and how they see the world and bash this and bash that and promote this and promote that without any sense of thinking about what are we linking ourselves to? What does that actually mean? Does that reflect my internal world? And parentheses, if it does genuinely reflect my deep internal world, do I really want to put that on Facebook? End parentheses. But is that even who I am to begin with? We've lost that. We've lost the art of seeking truth. We've entered into a world where people live, again, coming back to this concept of conformity, a word that I learned last year. I tend to be around a year behind everybody else. A word that I learned last year was the concept of the echo chamber. And since then, I spent a lot of time thinking about echo chambers. The concept that we go online and we create a digital footprint, and that what ends up happening, because the algorithms on all of these websites are so brilliant, whether it be Google or Facebook or some other search engine that's not Google, because who's using anything but Google, right? They know what I'm looking for. And so I see articles, and I see advertisements, and I see points of view that only singularly reflect my view. And I'm not even aware that there's another view out there. There's no conversation anymore. We've lost the ability to talk to each other. We've lost the ability to find and seek truth because there's no dialogue. There's just the repetition of things that I already believe in. And I believe in it because I'm being surrounded and being told that this is truth, and I'm a product of my digital footprint. My Migdal Bavel is my digital footprint. And so I repeat the things that I see. It's funny for me, because like I actually notice it because I only use the internet for like four different things. And I'm always like, why does... At the beginning, I was always like, why does every website have the same ads for the same silly thing that I buy my whatever on? And I realized that, like, that's my whole digital footprint, so they just keep sending me the same ad. I'm like, I already go to your website. Why do you want to keep sending me back there? I know. When I want something, I'll go there and I'll buy it from there. But that's it. That's the only place... That's my whole reality there. Because I don't click around. I don't really use internet for much except for Gmail. Except to respond to emails and things like that. And it's this frightening thing of these echo chambers. Of the fact that if I go to these types of websites, because I'm into this and I'm into that, that it's going to define who I am without any balance, without any discourse, without any back and forth. There are no longer two sides to the conversation. And that's produced new terms, like alternative facts. And I'm not claiming, and I'm not getting into politics about which side is right and which side is wrong. That's irrelevant to me. That's not my issue. That's not my topic. That's not my place. But the very fact that we live in a world where you get to pick which facts are true doesn't mean anything. There means that there is no such thing as a fact. A fact used to be truth. If we're saying that you have one fact and an alternative fact, and those two things are both, one of them has to be objectively true. And these two things, which cannot coexist, we're claiming are both true. I hold this is true and I hold this is true, but they can't both exist at the same time. It's not possible. Then the word fact no longer means anything. Then the word truth no longer means anything. You know, there are advertisements that I see on one place. I remember this. I'm always questioning things. It's part of who I am. These like truth advertisements about not smoking. I'm using that as an example because smoking is bad. Don't do it. It will kill you. Great. Good. You know I'm against smoking. But see, there were these ads. Truth. It just starts with truth, and then it starts quoting you statistics. I remember seeing one of this. I didn't look for the ad. I remember seeing one of the statistics, and I was like laughing to myself, like this is ridiculous. It was like X number, like it gave the percentage of people who make less money because they're smokers. There's no correlation does not imply causation. You don't make less money because you smoke. Where did you get that statistic from? So yes, I'm really happy that they're telling the world not to smoke because you'll make more money, but I hate to break it to you. If you stop smoking, you're probably not going to start magically making more money. It doesn't work like that, because correlation does not imply causation. That's not truth. Don't start with the word truth. That's a lie. Truth is smoking kills you. Truth is evidently smokers as a whole were making less money, assuming that that statistic is even true. But you can't just post that as though you're telling people stop smoking to close the wage gap. That's what it was saying. That's a lie. That's not truth. We're creating truth. How do we reestablish a reality of truth?
Good, I didn't get to any of the things I was afraid to quote and get to anyway. So we're good. If you could see all of my really interesting things that I printed out over here. After sheer.
How do we get to truth? We need to do what Avraham Avinu did. And there are two things that Avraham Avinu did. We need to start looking inside again. We can't just have a panim. We need a pnim. We need to take the time and the effort and the energy to define our internal world. Who are we? Who am I? What do I want? Now, it could be that that's not going to lead us to the proper conclusions. But if I don't know who I am, I can't go on my journey. I will never get to truth if there is no I. I need to legitimately define myself and who I am. We need to let go of being defined by society, being defined by our echo chambers, being defined by the little things that are jumping at us here and there. We need to leave all that behind. We need to... Don't hate me for this. I'm sorry for telling you to do this. You need to turn off your computer. You need to turn off your phone. You need to go into your room. You need to close the door and actually sit by yourself. Sit by yourself. And think, who am I? Without being influenced by anything or anyone else. Then, once you've figured out what you think and who you are, we need to start reestablishing an ancient tradition that worked for millennia. We need to bring back the art of conversation. We need to stop posting and yelling and staying away from people who disagree with us. We need to start asking questions and talking to people. We don't talk to each other anymore.
The one thing that I will quote from, I recommend everybody read it. It's an incredible TED Talk. Everybody watch it. By Theo E.J. Wilson, called A Black Man Goes Undercover in the Alt-Right. Fascinating. And he's a brilliant speaker. He's also really fun to listen to because he's such a great orator. And his whole point in that TED Talk is that we need to start talking to each other again. This is the story of a black man who was the victim of police brutality, who lost a friend to it, and who said, I don't understand who these people are who are bashing black people. But he said, I want to figure that out. And so, using his words, he created a ghost profile, whatever that means. He created a ghost profile, created a fake Facebook name and fake identity on the internet. He beat the algorithms because he couldn't find other stuff because the internet was only feeding him what he wanted to see, what his digital footprint was. And he created a digital footprint of being a white supremacist. And you listen to his talk, and I don't want to spoil it for you. You should watch him say it. But he finds that he has far more in common with the deep fears of white supremacists than he does disagree with them. And he says, listen, I'm never going to be friends with them, and I don't agree with them, and anybody doesn't want me on this planet, I don't want to be friends with. But I was shocked to find that the base of our fears was basically the same. And he therefore works toward creating conversation again, bringing conversation back. I'm not going to quote the stuff that I took from him. You'll see it. You can watch it on your own again. It's a brilliant TED Talk. But I want to finish off with this Torah, and we're coming to the last few minutes. To me, that's the other... Can I have a source sheet? There we go. That's the other key piece of this midrash. How does Avraham Avinu become Avraham Avinu? He doesn't become Avraham Avinu because everybody told him to be Avraham Avinu. He doesn't become Avraham Avinu because it's cool to be counterculture. There was penalty of death for being counterculture. When he goes to Nimrod, he doesn't suck it up. He doesn't be silent. He doesn't even look at Nimrod and say, Don't talk to me. You're an idolater. He doesn't walk away from the conversation. He challenges his father. If they don't move and they don't talk, why do you bow to them? I want to understand. He looks at Nimrod and says, why should I bow to fire if water puts out fire? He wasn't being snarky. He wasn't being cynical. Those are things that exist in our generation. That's how we view that story. This is not when he was looking at Nimrod in the face and was not fazed by him and said, you want to talk? Let's talk. Explain to me why you would bow down to fire if it could be put out with water. There was a conversation. Those conversations defined Avraham. And on the flip side, those conversations defined every convert that he had. It wasn't through coercion. It wasn't through social dynamics. It wasn't through Facebook algorithms. He walked around, opened up his tent, invited people in. They said, thank you so much. He said, what do you mean? They said, well, you just gave me food, so thank you. It's common courtesy, politeness. Is that not a thing in Judaism? You're the first Jew. You get to decide. And he was like, no, you're thanking the wrong person. I didn't make the food. God did. Thank him. He opened up his tent to start conversations. Conversations that he believed would lead to truth. Not my truth, not a truth, but the truth. We need to claim the truth. We need to reclaim in this generation the truth of ourselves and the ultimate truth of the world. There's a lot of great sources here that we don't have time to quote. Like Hillel and Shammai, the fact that the reason why, one of the reasons why we pass them like Hillel and over Shammai is because when Shammai would talk in their Beis Medrash, they would quote their own opinion. And when Hillel would talk in the Beis Medrash, first they would quote Shammai, then they would quote, Hillel would quote their own opinion. Because they were engaged in dialogue in different perspectives. And that led to a reality of Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. That's how they got to truth. There are multiple facets to truth, but if it's not truth, it doesn't count. You can only have Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim if you're talking truth. Truth isn't monolithic. There is one God, but there are 600,000 ways of getting there. Each Jew has their own journey to get to the one truth. But because I took that road to get to the ultimate truth, I therefore am funneling it through my unique perspective. That's what makes it both truth and mine. That's Avraham. That's what we're tasked with doing. That's what we're supposed to be doing. I'll quote this last source and we'll end with this because I believe I'm over time already. Yeah. I'll quote this last source, which jumped out at me, and then I was so excited because I didn't know that in the source it actually talks about Avraham. I was like, yes, that's how I know this is truth. Because I looked it up and I wanted to quote the source, and this source quotes Avraham Avinu. That's to me when I said this sheer is MS. Because you got to search and you got to question yourself. And here this source number 11, the Rambam Hilchos Tshuva. Ha'oved mi'ava osek b'Torah v'mitzvos. One who serves God out of Ava does Torah and mitzvos. V'holech b'netivot chachochma and works in ways of wisdom. Lo mipnei davar sheba'olam, not because of any external factor. V'lo mipnei yirat haro'eh. And not because he's afraid of anything. V'lo kidei l'reish tova, not even for schar. Hear the words. These are perhaps the most critical words of this year. Ela oseh ha'emet mipnei shehu emet. You do truth because it's truth. There is no greater value than truth in that way. V'sof ha'tova lo l'olah. And if you get good because of it, great. U'ma'ala zo ma'ala g'dala ma'od ve'ein kol chacham zochela. And this is a great ma'ala not everybody zochet to. V'hu ma'alat avravinu. That was the ma'ala of Avraham Avinu. He was unrelenting in finding truth. Lech Lecha tells us it was his perspective on that one ultimate truth. But the two can live in tandem. You can have different perspectives on one ultimate truth. And that's when we can come together as one true society. That's when we can be Safa Achat V'Rikim. And in the world to come, we're all going to speak one language and be of one mind. We're going to be a whole world that believes in the same one truth and stands around in a circle around that truth, looking at it from a different perspective, all embracing the unique aspect, our unique perspective of the one singular, undeniable truth that we each bring out. That's the utopian society that we're fighting for. Those were the seeds planted by Avraham Avinu. We should be zocha to have the courage to define who we are, as though that weren't hard enough, to then, once we know who we are, to then go on the journey to figure out, is who I am truth? And be willing to give up some of who I am in the name of truth and for the sake of truth. give up my artzacham, latzacham, mavitzacham, give up everything if I have to. I need to know who I am, but to give up everything if I have to for truth. And Bezrat Hashem, when that day comes, we should all come together to that one ultimate truth, and in doing so, bring Yimot HaMashiach Mihera B'Yameinu. Shkach.